Welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host...
Tim Elshai. You paused there.
I did pause there because...
So you didn't forget me.
I didn't forget you. I'm so glad we're together here in studio. You brought in a guest, and we're going to talk collectibles, trading cards.
Yeah, somebody I've known for a long, long time. John, something you and I haven't talked about until now. I actually broke into journalism, writing about trading cards for Beckett Baseball Card Monthly, and my editor... was the guy we're going to talk to today, cool. Tracy Hackler, who today is the senior brand manager for Panini America.
Right. And the timing of this episode is impeccable because just in the last few days, there's been some record-breaking trading card news. Think about this. This is the secondary trading market. This isn't going to the card shop and buying your cards, your collectibles. This is the secondary market. Since really the first 3 months of this year, over $616 million has been traded with, yes, trading cards. Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you think about like just the economic scale of pieces of cardstock.
Right.
But as we're going to get into with Tracy, not all trading cards are physical cards anymore.
Right.
Right.
But there were a couple. Here's what's really interesting. There were a couple of physical cards. Yes, in mint condition, that were recently traded. Get this, a 1997 Kobe Bryant card was sold for $3.17 million.
Which is incredible. Do you have any idea what made it so expensive?
It was a one of 30. They did a special color with it, and there were only 30 of these cards in all the world in circulation. And then also, there was a baseball card, Aaron Judge. His 2017 card was acquired for $1.95 million.
I mean, these are, you know, guys in this case who played in, you know, in the lifetime of us and, you know, probably in the adulthoods of us, right?
Yeah.
And probably most people listening, too. And it's so fascinating when you think about, John, the growth of the trading card market.
Right.
It used to be, a 1933 Babe Ruth. Or
the old Honus
Wagner
card.
Yeah,
right.
Honus Wagner,
right.
Mickey
right.
Mantle.
Right.
You know, these old cards in mint condition, you know, that are so hard to find. It used to be those. And it still is.
But these are contemporary players.
Right.
Yeah, right. So we're going to talk and we're going to dig deeper into that conversation. So stay tuned for our interview with Tracy Hackler from Panini America. But before that, I just wanted to, Tim, talk a little bit about, you know, we do focus a lot on what's happening in the world of women's sports and what's happening with the growth and the explosion in some cases
right.
of women's sport. And in particular, the Women's Professional Hockey League just announced its ninth franchise in Hockey Town, Detroit.
Detroit. It checks all the boxes. Great hockey town. For whatever it's worth, and I think it's worth a lot, you can draw in a strong Canadian audience in Detroit,
sure.
right across the border from Windsor. You know, facility, they've got the facility.
I got to say, it's a large facility
yeah.
because in talking to a lot of the executives, including our prior guests, Amy Scheer was on the program almost a year ago, and I'd encourage our listeners to go back and listen to that. They were really focused on buildings between 8 and 12,000 seats. Here, with the recent explosion of the women's game, they're now comfortable going into 18,000 seat arenas.
Right. They're comfortable going into what we would think of as NHL
right.
size arenas. Right. And that's what makes me so happy to see this. Well, it's one of many things that makes me see this. I'm glad this league's expanding, but I'm so happy they're expanding now into arenas that are large.
Yeah.
Right. And they've already got that in the New York market, in New Jersey. Minnesota, right.
Seattle was another one.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, nine's a weird number. So I'm thinking, I'm going to look into the Skin of the Game crystal ball here. I think there will be a 10th team announced. Any venture to guess where that team might be?
Well, I'm wishing and hoping you would say Buffalo, since we're sitting here right now. You are a man of Cleveland. Do you want to venture a guess or maybe more
guess,
than a guess?
And I do have sources, although no one will go on record with me. You know, I am going to predict Hamilton, Ontario will be the 10th team in the league.
Which would be, again, an incredible choice. Big arena, practically a new arena, completely refurbished arena.
16,000 seats.
Yep, 16,000.
Nice
you can draw from Buffalo. You can draw, of course, from Toronto, which also has a
And create a nice rivalry
right
there.
Yep. I mean, it's worked in the Canadian Football League, like the Argos and the Ticats.
Right.
Incredible rivalry. If that's happening in football, you know it can happen in hockey.
Yeah, so stay tuned for that.
I sure hope you're right.
But in the meantime, our friends in Detroit need to come up with a name. They need to come up with a logo. None of that's been divulged yet.
If there's a marketing person who's, you know, a fan.
No, so it's going to be, so it gives the Detroit team an opportunity to create more news in the upcoming months. You'll see a logo, you'll see a name. I'm sure they're working right now on all that, including, and here's just a kind of a little bit of inside baseball. You know, the number one thing that a new team or a new property needs to figure out is coming up with a name that they can own that is trademarkable. So right now, I'm not sure quite the creative people are starting on the name. It's really more the legal team on what name can we own.
Yeah, I'm thinking of something we talked about before, but you know, the Toronto Scepters and a logo that was overlapping a little bit with a Taylor Swift.
Created some news.
Song. Yeah. Kind of fun news. But yeah, no, it'll be great to see what they come up with. And just, I mean, congrats to everybody involved there, the executives, the coaches, the players, especially the players. You know, we had Katie Knoll, you know, from Minnesota on the show last summer. What an incredible league.
It's on a roll. So as you said, kudos to the organization, the team, the players. So yes, Detroit is team number 9. I do predict, and you can hold me to this, I've been wrong once or twice, but I'm really thinking Hamilton makes a lot of sense, a lot of momentum behind that building and that market. So stay tuned here on Skin in the Game. We'll report back. But before that, we do need to get to our guests. We have Tracy Hackler from Panini America is going to talk all about the real big business of trading cards and collectibles.
That's right. And by the way, John, we should mention too, you're going to hear us in the interview allude to some legal action that's going on. People can look it up because this stuff changes and evolves depending when you're listening or watching. You know, Panini and Fanatics are engaged in a lawsuit that Tracy will acknowledge he's not going to dig into. The fact he's not a lawyer is going to play to his advantage here. But this is how competitive the trading card market has become. You've got antitrust lawsuits happening as, you know, these companies go after licenses and compete for licenses. So
you're saying it's evolved a little bit since we used to put trading cards in our the spokes of our bikes?
Oh, did you do that?
I actually did.
Oh, did you? By the time it got to me, people were like, oh, I'm going to collect these cards and hope they're worth something.
Right. And with that, let's get to Tracy Hackler from Panini America.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, absolutely, man. Appreciate you guys having me on. This will be fun.
Oh, you got it. I'm saying it's so great to reconnect with you too. And we'll get into your career history and maybe even a little bit about how you and I met, because you made a big difference in my career. But let's start with the big picture first, Tracy. The sports collectibles hobby has changed so much, not only over the decades, but I feel like over the last few years. What's your take on the health of the sports collectibles market overall right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as healthy as it's ever been. I think the whole COVID pandemic era was kind of the line of demarcation of just a whole new frontier that launched with, oddly enough, the pandemic. And I think the rise of modern sports cards as recently as the 80s and 90s, I mean, the cards that moved the needle, the cards that got all the headlines were attic finds of vintage baseball cards, primarily some football, but vintage stuff. And as it turned into the late 90s, into the early 2000s, modern cards started to become a little bit more in vogue as well and chased. And then kind of just technology rose at a rapid clip from not just print technology and substrates, what the cards were printed on, but autographs and memorabilia and all those things kind of snowballed into this COVID era, unprecedented in terms of participants, people buying and collecting and trading cards, and just the overall amount of money that was being spent on cards was at a place it had never been before.
Hey, Tracy, John Semperman here. Thanks again, too, for joining us.
Hey, John.
It looks like you've gone from journalism into collectibles. You know, kind of give us a little bit of your trajectory to where you're at now with Panini.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up collecting sports cards with my brother Tim, and I think I started in 1978. I was like 8 years old and always knew that I wanted a career in sports. And I realized pretty early in my high school career that I was not going to go any further with my athletic pursuit. I loved journalism. I loved sports writing. I grew up in the Dallas area. We were fortunate to have one of the best sports sections at the time, back when newspapers were a thing, back when people read those and waited on their doorsteps every morning. So wanted to be a sports writer, and I went to school for journalism. Was lucky enough to get an internship at the time it was called Beckett Publications, and they were the sports card authority, the Bible for sports card values and coverage of the industry. I got my start there as an intern in the summer of 1995. By December of that same year, they called me back full time, and kind of my journey into this phenomenal, fantastic world of sports cards was born. And it's actually at Beckett where I met your co-host. And Tim was a writer, and he hit us up via, back in the day, people actually wrote letters on paper that they sent in the U.S. Postal
Wow, that's a
Service. And
we
crazy
did,
thought.
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You had
And Tim,
to write in order to hopefully write, right?
Yeah.
And to get a
Yeah.
response, you put a self-addressed stamped envelope in there too,
Wow.
unless you
Yeah.
got a phone call.
An SASE. And so Tim wrote and just wanted to be a contributor. For me, at that time, I was kind of just new in the company, but realized a lot about Tim, just his professionalism and his stick-to-itiveness or dedication. And so I put him to work writing feature stories for us, because I at that time I'd kind of grown into doing baseball and football and basketball and all the magazines that we did. And Tim was a frequent contributor to a lot of our titles. So I've always had a great respect for Tim, and always enjoyed my interactions with him and my time I spent with him. But yeah, so that's how my journey into sports cards launched. And then fast forward 30 years through a bunch of different stops, on the content side, on the marketing and advertising side, PR side, production and manufacturing side. If you would have told 8-year-old me that I was what I was going to be doing for a living, I would have told you were crazy. And yet, lo and behold, here I am. So just feel extremely blessed, and still am filled with passion about this industry, the hobby. I got into it not because it was valuable, not because there was money to be made, but because I really loved all the lessons that you can learn about business, about life, about everything else that sports cards provides if you give it a chance. And so the fact that I'm still in this 30 years later has been pretty remarkable.
Tracy, first of all, before I even go further, thank you for the kind words. Know how much I appreciate it. And, I was telling John before we jumped on with you, writing for Beckett was transformational in my career, but it was also really cool because writing for Beckett Baseball Card Monthly and football, hockey, basketball, racing. I remember there was a racing magazine back in the day. What an incredible way to write about sports, but also write about collectibles, to write about something that was a hobby, so a form of entertainment, but also a form of engagement, a hobby that people loved and still love so much. And that's my question for you. For somebody who, collected cards as a kid or as a younger adult and, who stepped away from it, if they were to go grab a pack of cards now and open it up, what would surprise them?
Well, I think a lot of things would surprise them. Probably the cost might surprise them a little bit, depending on what pack they got. It is a little bit more expensive these days, but I think the payoff for that is what they might also find inside the pack, which is a better technology, whiz-bang special effects from foil color to optochrome technology, memorabilia pieces of game-worn jerseys or hats or bases or footballs or race tires. I mean, those are in cards now. Autographs, where we contract with athletes in all sports to sign autographs that we then put in packs. And sometimes it's a golden ticket. One of the big advances in the industry as a whole over the last several years, the what we call a chase card, which is, or like a chase insert, which is a really rare, kind of cool card that might only fall once per case or so of a product. And a lot of people go opening box after box, looking for those chase cars. So just technology is huge. The colors of inks and just the substrates, what the card's printed on, the effects it has if you tilt it in your wrist, a lot of those things would probably surprise in a pleasant way a lot of collectors who may have stepped away for a long time and came back.
It sounds like, because I've been following a little bit of this one of one kind of phenomenon, it kind of reminds me, Tracy, of kind of the Willy Wonka golden ticket, right? Is that kind of that phenomenon and what's driving people? Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
That motivates a lot of collectors. And one of the things that I've always loved about this industry, and it may sound hokey or corny, is like, you can collect however you want to collect. Like, you make the rules. So if you want to collect your favorite player, your favorite team, you want to collect a certain color of this cool insert, and there's a green version, you want to collect all the greens.
Right.
Players that have your last name, players that have your first name. I mean, there's no rules. And so I think it's more than just the financial gain. It's always been that way for me and for so many other collectors. It's about the other kind of intrinsic qualities of a card that aren't always revolving around dollars and cents. I mean, yes, it is a lot of people's livelihoods are at stake, but it's also so much more than that too.
Well, what I love about the fact we're talking about trading cards, right, is it's throwback, at least for me, to a different era, yep. But it's also refreshing in today's digital era where I don't even have tickets now to sporting events because it's a QR code, right? So the ability to have something that you can touch, something that you can mount on a wall, something you could, it's good to see us going back to that more, that tactile collectible versus everything digital, right? This is actually something you can touch.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how many times still today. I mean, I see people who will get a card that has a piece of memorabilia in a jersey and they'll smell it, right? And they want to touch the jersey and that tactile nature will never leave the industry. And I think, digital has been great in many facets of all of our lives. And there's a lot of convenience that you gain from that. But the traditional kind of in person, I want to feel it. I want to touch it. I want to smell it.
I want to trade it.
Yeah. And the digital marketplace hasn't found a way to recreate that or to harness that the way that the in-person exchange always will win. And so I think we get all the benefits of the technology and the internet while keeping the traditional kind of old-fashioned face-to-face feel of what we've always known.
A lot of trading card companies and collectible companies, including Panini, have entered that digital marketplace, to varying levels. So, Tracy, for people who aren't familiar, can you describe what that looks like?
Yeah, absolutely, Tim. We've done a very robust business with our blockchain environment, our blockchain marketplace. We have a person that I work closely with here, Court Peters, who's dedicated solely to the blockchain space and creating digital collectibles. A lot of those are based on our physical products, and he sells digital packs. He sells individual digital cards, and there's a very healthy collector base for those. I think there's some crossover between physical and digital, but I think there's also we found to be digital only collectors as well who invest a lot of money. It's just growing kind of month over month, year over year. It continues to grow. It continues to be one of our focuses here. And I think one of the things that's cool about the blockchain space here at Panini is the way that Court and his team can make the cards kind of come to life in the blockchain format that you don't really have that luxury when the card's in your hand. Yeah, it looks cool. And if the light hits the foil the right way, it's going to do a little dance for you. But on the blockchain side, it's just lit up like a disco, and you can turn the card there's just a lot of special effects that don't necessarily translate to the kind of in-person experience. And so I think we will continue to explore that space and take advantage of it and be a leading player in that space as it relates to trading cards.
Tracy, on that blockchain platform or in that blockchain area, do you find that if you were to generalize, collectors are coming in purely to collect these digital pieces, or are they looking at them as like a solid investment?
That's a great question, Tim. I think just from my experience, I think most people are coming in to collect them, but some of our biggest blockchain participants are lifelong collectors who also see the appeal of having this investment piece as well. And there's definitely a market for them. And we see it every time Court releases a pack product that sells out in 45 seconds, and the cards are immediately being opened and traded on the blockchain site, and it's remarkable to see. So I think a lot of those people are collectors at heart, but they also see the potential of investment upside.
I'm not a blockchain guy, Tim. I'm just trying to figure out, in kind of layperson's terms here, Tracy. So they buy these quote unquote digital cards, right? How do they share those? I mean, are they putting them up on a projector in their game room? What's that kind of that emotional connection then that they have with these cards, digital cards that they now are in possession of?
One is that you own it, and it's usually on your phone or your device, your laptop. You have it forever unless you want to move it on the blockchain. The history, the transactional history of that card provenance, is kept forever. So you can see when it was first opened and when it was sold, who bought it, when it was sold again, who bought it, the price. I mean, everything is there for everyone to see. But I think the overall allure, because they are cool, right? I never have to worry about a blockchain card getting damaged. It's not going to have a ding corner. It's not going to have a scratch on the surface. It's always going to be pristine mint condition.
Your mom's not going to sell them in a garage sale, right?
Right. I'm not going to put it in my bicycle spokes. Right. I'm not going to put it in my bicycle spokes. So there's quite a bit of appeal to those. Like, I'm not the biggest blockchain guy, right, but I've got a few blockchain cards and I love them. I love to look at them. You can use your finger and drag, and you can turn it around, look at the back. And
yeah,
it is a very cool element of the trading card industry that's really grown over the last decade or so.
We're here with Tracy Hackler, who's the senior brand manager of Panini America, and we're talking everything trading cards, both digital and physical. Tracy, what I've been following, and I'm really interested in your perspective on kind of the up and coming sports, who's hot, maybe who's not as hot, you know, and what are some of these emerging sports where you're seeing that translating to the collectible business?
I think I have to start with the WNBA. I think that sport, that league, its players have really skyrocketed over the last 3 years. Certainly it doesn't hurt when you have a draft class like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, followed by Paige Beckers and Kiki Arifin. And I think this year's draft class with AZ Fudd and Olivia Miles and others, obviously Caitlin coming into the space brought a lot of eyeballs and really enhanced the league's following a great deal. And then kind of last year's class with Paige Beckers and Kiki and Sonia Citrone and others kind of added more eyeballs to it. And now it's off and rolling. And so I think WNBA has been strong for us as a license. We're thrilled to have it. We've had great success kind of year over year. National Women's Soccer League, NWSL, is a new license for us this year. I think there's a lot of upside there, a lot of potential, a lot of superstars that people know from international play or playing in it. So we just kind of launched offerings on the NWSL side. It's been a early success. I think that will continue. And I think a sport like NASCAR has obviously been around for quite a while, but new young drivers are coming up and making an impact. We see it probably before a lot of other people see it, because we see how people react to their trading cards. And so we can kind of get an early indication of how a driver might perform throughout the season, how the sport might perform overall compared to year over year. So, and then I think soccer across the board internationally and domestically is going to be a huge growth area this year, especially because the World Cup's in the US and Canada and Mexico. I think it's a real opportunity for all the international leagues that the World Cup players will represent will all benefit from it. And obviously the World Cup is kind of part of Panini's DNA. So we're excited about that as well.
Well, it's so interesting that you brought up, you know, the WNBA and the National Women's Soccer League as well, because Tim and I spend a lot of time here on Skin in the Game talking about the growth and the momentum of women's sports. So that's reinforcement to kind of what we were thinking. But here's my question. Who's buying those cards? Is it demographically, is it women? Is it girls? Is it men? Is it boy? Is it? It just sounds like you may have doubled the amount of your target audience now also investing in collectibles.
Women's sports is not the only thing exploding, because we're also seeing a rise in the participation of women in the hobby. More women now than there ever have been at shows. You see them at the National every year. You see them influencing online. They've added such another dimension to the marketplace, and it's been so exciting to see. So I think, to answer your question, the bottom line is people are going to buy what they can make money on. And I think it speaks to the appeal and the popularity of the WNBA and the NWSL that you see more women collectors, but you also see the traditional collectors of football cards or basketball cards or baseball cards, who see a real opportunity, not just to make money in these other women's leagues, but also to appeal to their, if they're hobby shops or they're online retailers, they need to have the inventory to appeal to those same people as well.
Tracy, the licensing landscape is obviously shifting straight across the industry. And anyway, you know, people have been paying attention to the news know that Panini is in an ongoing legal dispute with Fanatics that's playing out in the courts and in the background right now. Not asking you to get into the legal specifics of that case.
Unless, of course, you want to. Right?
I mean, if you want to, but since I don't see an ESQ Esquire after your name, we'll skip that part.
Yes, I appreciate that.
You're good with that one. All right, but here's what I am wondering. How does Panini think about competing in an environment where those rights are in flux, and even just broadening that out a bit more, where licensing is changing, there's a lot to go after, and there's increasing competition or tougher competition for it all at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I think our DNA here is to do what we do best with what we have, and I think that's been our mantra since I started here back in 2010. We do our level best not to pay attention to any of the outside noise and just put our head down. We have such brand equity in all of our brands that have been around for decades. And so I think they're the brand tenets that we've built those brands on. Those remain the same. We continue to try to push the envelope creatively with technology, with marketing initiatives, and really just focus on what we can control. I mean, it's kind of the old coaching adage, you know, but control what you can control.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, and Tim, when I looked at Tim and Tracy, I guess for our listeners, you know, license versus non-license. And license, I don't want to say simply means, but that's an arrangement with the league to use their uniforms in their markets. And non-license, and I assume this is the case, Tracy, is really you're forming a partnership with the Players Association. Is that correct? And still doing their likenesses, maybe without the team branding.
With the players, yeah.
Right. And well, you brought up players. Where will and where does kind of name, image, and likeness come into this? And where do we see this kind of starting to go in collegiate sports? Maybe give me a little one-on-one on where collectibles stand now with name, image, and likeness opening up.
That's another part of our business that's really changed over the last several years as the whole NIL landscape has changed as well. We've tried to be on the leading edge of that even back in the day. And I think it's a bigger part of our business than it's ever been. And it usually or often provides our first foray into the relationships with these players that hopefully we have for their entire careers, from when they're in high school now till when they retire and they're in the Hall of Fame for many, many of them. But it's a new frontier for sure. It's just so interesting, kind of as a fan myself, to watch and see how that has changed and the kind of money that's available now to these kids that was never available before. I'm married to a great woman who was a college golfer. And you know, she bemoans now that the NIL wasn't around when she was around, because she thinks she missed out on some revenue, you know, and who's to argue with that, right? Like collectibles are a big part of the NIL space, but it's just one small part too, right? Because it's also car dealerships and fast food restaurants and all these other things that were never available, at least not legally, to these athletes. And to watch what it's done to some of the college sports, for me, like as a fan watching it, like I felt like every player is a 1 year free agent. And
Right.
if things don't, and that is such a wild notion to anybody who watched sports back in the day, and players played their whole entire professional careers with the same franchise, let alone the college game.
We're here with Tracy Hackler, the senior brand manager for Panini America. Tracy, I want to ask you about the value of cards and specifically how collectors can find out how much what they have is worth. Nowadays, of course, I mean, there are apps that people can open up, scan a card, and instantly get the value. Are those accurate? And even taking that just to, widening that lens a bit, what are the best ways that people can assess the value of what they own?
Tim, I distinctly remember so many times back when I worked at Beckett, and people, like whole sections of people, wouldn't move their cards until the new Beckett came out because they didn't want to take a loss, or they didn't want to sell for too low, and so people would wait until their magazine came in the mail, and they would get the magazine, they'd find their card and say, oh, it's got an up arrow and it's $5. And people wouldn't move a card until the new Beckett came out. And obviously, that's changed just so completely in the last 10 years or so, with the kind of the advent and the proliferation of real-time data. It's really easy, or so much easier now, to find out what your card's worth because you have so much real-time data that's crunched and provided on your phone. And that's as easy as looking at one of the giant auction sites like eBay, and you can go check out completed auctions and see what your card or cards like the one you're trying to value have sold for in the last week, 10 days, 2 months. And then there's documented sales history of all the big cards, either on Beckett or on any of the various card pricing apps or cataloging apps. You've got auction prices from some of the giants, Goldin or eBay, PWCC, or whoever you prefer. It's not hard to find a really accurate price range of what you're trying to buy or sell within a few seconds.
Right. And then, as with the stock market or anything else with fluctuating values or prices, every sale drives the next sale, right? Just like, I mean, even like real estate,
For
I mean,
sure.
essentially, right? If people want to understand it, just think of it that way.
100%, Tim. And it's also the market itself is so swiftly changing too. It's like you can have a card of a relative unknown, and they have a three touchdown, 180 yard performance, and the next day it's double, triple, quadruple in price. It's
Crazy.
that part of the business is maybe not talked about as much, but the way that element of the industry has changed, probably it goes underreported. I still, like, as a guy who was around before all this, right? It's like to think that prices could change on a card in during a game, during a first quarter. It's remarkable. A guy hits a great shot at the buzzer, and his cards will shoot up in value immediately. It's just it's been fun to watch. Absolutely.
Do you find too, Tracy, if a player has something that happens outside the game, it happens off the field, whether it's good or bad, can that drive the price of a card a bit up or down?
They can, for sure. I mean, I think any of those off-field incidents, to your point, I mean, I'm trying to think of an off-field incident that would increase a card value. Maybe like
Well, I would say
a
maybe
life-saving.
Travis Kelce getting engaged to Taylor Swift. I would think that would increase the
Well,
value.
that is a good point, but that is a good point. But I think the value of his went up when he started dating her,
Right.
like a Hall of Fame. Sure, like Hall of Fame announcement would be, I guess, technically an off-field thing. But absolutely, Tim. Like, it's collectors are human too, and if they see something that they don't like, or that d doesn't mesh with who they thought they were collecting, you will see cards being unloaded at fractions of the price. And
so, Tracy, this is great. I was hoping to go down this little bit of a rabbit hole, and we, you know, everybody always talks about, you know, the unicorn, right? The Hannes Wagner card, right? Mm-hmm. Have there been any recent kind of examples, or is there, or are there other unicorns out there?
You do see now more than ever. And that's one of the things that you really, it was a real indication that things were changing during the pandemic, is it was the first time really that a modern era card or cards were generating millions of dollars in secondary market sales, whether it was the Luka Doncic 101 NBA logo man card or the Giannis Antetokounmpo logo man autograph rookie. I mean, those cards were bringing just ridiculous, what seemed like ridiculous money, because prior to that time frame, and Tim can attest, like those types of dollars were spent for the Hannes Wagner stuff or the Mickey Mantle graded nines. And during the COVID explosion, you started to see for the first time those modern era cards bringing that kind of money and interest. And so I think you have those types of cards in just about every year, whether it's take any of your superstars, your Lucas, your LeBrons, your Mahomes, and you get that one-on-one card that has the autograph or a piece of a jersey he wore in the Super Bowl, and you'll see big money paid and a lot of eyeballs on it. And it, a lot of times it's just a matter of who has it, when they're going to surface, and where are they going to sell it. Now more than ever, modern era cards, you get those kind of golden ticket type cards that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Every year that will surface.
And we're talking millions of dollars in some cases, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, prior to the COVID explosion, I hate to keep referencing that, but it was such a kind of a line of demarcation from what it was to what it is now. And that was the first time really that 2, 3, 4 year old trading cards were generating millions of dollars in secondary market sales. You just never really saw that before.
How does the global marketplace play into this? You know, I'm thinking about, you know, great baseball players from, you know, Japan, for example, and there have been great baseball players from, you know, all corners of the globe for as long as any of us have been watching the game. But Tracy, as you're describing it now with, you know, with the marketplace being as global as it is and the ability to buy and sell internationally and going back to, you know, blockchain collectibles, the ability to, you know, sell something instantly and transfer ownership instantly. So how does interest from countries around the globe play into the marketplace that's based here in North America?
Well, I think it plays a huge part in it. I think you've seen that. I mean, for years, like Australia is always a big basketball country, and Asia has always been kind of into soccer and basketball. But I think you see the marketplace now is more global than it ever has been for all the right reasons, in terms of just ease of participation and how to get into it. And I've really seen over the last, I don't know, nine years, is the international collector, they've kind of come around to the North American way of collecting, which, I mean, there was a learning curve, because obviously the kinds of cards that we've made in North America for years and that we've kind of perfected with the technologies and the memorabilia and the autographs, those weren't always available over there. So they've had to kind of change the way they collect, but it's so much easier now than it ever has been to do that. So you see all the cards that are popular here, all the sports, they're just as popular over abroad as they've ever been. And I think that the growth area international for sports like soccer, for tennis, we see a robust international market for, we have a deal with Yannick Sinner, who's the number one ranked tennis player in the world. And a lot of international people are buying his Panini cards. But to go back to the soccer and the women's sports that we talked about, NWSL, the WNBA, Major League Wrestling, Professional Fight League, like we see that international audience, because there's so many international participants in those sports. They find their players and they find their American cards and they buy them and they trade them, not just in their home countries, but also over here. So it's growing kind of every day, probably. and the sophistication of that consumer has grown so much as well.
And Tracy, as we wrap up here, I just one more question on this kind of this international landscape. You know, Panini is a global company. Are there sports, you know, that are completely random or foreign to the American or Canadian market that Panini is producing sports, you know, from other countries? Just for our listeners, are there some random sports out there that one wouldn't think would have a collectible card industry, but it does?
A great question. Man, I'm trying to think just real quick.
Well, and is it cricket? Is it rugby? Is it something even more obscure than that, that you would not think of it being having such fandom?
A Tour de France maybe could be one that not a lot of people might realize there's cards for, but we're in that space. And then the other ones that you bring up are compelling as well. But
what's that Lance Armstrong? What's that Lance Armstrong card worth now?
Speaking of off the field of play,
right? His values may have fallen in that time. Yeah, a time long ago, of course.
Surfing, skateboarding. I'm just keeping Jobs got me thinking here. You know, and we can name like again great
sports.
Athletes. Yeah, great athletes for all of
Yeah.
Here. Yeah. All right, before we let you go,
sure.
Tracy, we're going to bring you back to a question that I think everybody at some point in their life can relate to or know somebody who can, and it's going to be a nice place to wrap our conversation because it brings it back to, at least for the three of us, where we probably all started. I'll give you a scenario. Okay. So let's say we're at our parents' house and we have to either empty it out or we you know, find something from our childhood. We find a box full of baseball cards. We find a box full of hockey cards. And, you know, they're from the 80s or 90s or early 2000s, whatever they're from. And we want to find out what they're worth and figure out what we could potentially do with them. What are the best steps to take?
I think initially, if you have a kind of a rough idea of what you're looking at and you can turn it over and you can see, okay, this is this brand, this from this year. The first thing you probably do, I would do, go to eBay real quick and just kind of look around and see what something, oh, I've got this Gordie Howe card. What year is it? What card number is it? I would kind of search it up and see what's it worth. Are there ones like it? And then I think I would probably do a little research that way. Take the box. You need to find somebody you trust. Okay, because you never know what could be hidden in that box. It may all seem like kind of not cheap. They could all seem like cheap and expensive cards, but you might have one that's an error card that was really valuable, or it might have one of the golden ticket cards in there that you might not know. So I would maybe find a local hobby shop in your area that you trust, and then maybe reach out to them. And they will certainly have more information for you, can kind of lead you in the right direction. They could even tell you, yeah, these are cool. These, we're not buying them. I worked at a shop for about a year and a half, Roadshow Cards, and they have shops across the country. And I worked there. The number of people that would come in with like a late 80s, early 90s cards, and we had to break their heart every time and tell them, not only are we not going to buy these, but you're going to have a hard time getting anything of value out of these just because, Tim, as you know, it was the overproliferation, overproduction era. And so that's always a tough conversation to have. But I think educate yourself as much as you can. Find somebody you trust that might can steer you in the right direction just on what you have and what the best maybe methods of either liquidating, if you want to do that, restoring, grading, you might want to do that. I guess it also depends on what your goals are. If you want to keep them, if you want to get rid of them.
Very good. And protect those cards, right? Like find, you know, go to your local hobby shop and
yes.
You know, get whatever you need to put them in the, you know, in the right kind of sleeves or the right kind of
exactly.
Box,
yeah.
Right?
And any hobby shop worth its salt is going to help a customer when they come in and say, hey, I don't know what I have. What is this?
Right.
And they should be able to like say, okay, these two are good. These 300, not so good or whatever it is. Right. And information is so readily available now with the click of a few buttons. So there's no reason not to have at least a broad understanding of what you're looking at, what you're holding, and what you have.
Well, I, for one, am going to head down to the basement and see what I have now. I'm motivated. I don't think I have much, but it'll at least be a catalyst, maybe to clear out the basement.
As long as it wasn't late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah. If it was earlier than that, you're good. If you have any Hannes Wagner, Mickey Mantle, Babe Ruth, let me and Tim help you out.
I know a guy. All right, well, Tracy, listen, this was awesome to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Great to reconnect with you.
Yes, sir, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to introduce you to John and to everybody out there. So, Tracy Hackler, Senior Brand Manager of Panini America, thank you for joining us on Skin in the Game.
Hey, thank you, guys. Appreciate y'all.
Thanks, Tracy. Be well.
All right. All right, John, you too.
Boy, Tim, it brought back a lot of memories of trading cards and collectibles, and the industry is still, actually, it's not even still, it's continues to grow. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, and just to hear, like, two things jumped out at me, John. One was just how vibrant the industry is
right now.
And I knew that. I've although I haven't collected in a long time, I have gone to some sports card shows. I've taken my nephew. I've gone out of interest. Visited, Dave and Adams Card Shop, which is, started in Buffalo, has a huge store right outside of Times Square in New York City. You walk in there, right there, that's, instantly you can see how big this is. That jumped out, but also you asked Tracy a question. What does the demographics of this market look like now as women's professional sports are exploding? We're also seeing more women come into the sports collecting hobby, which is fantastic.
Right, because, you think of the stereotype of baseball trading cards, right? And you see those images of kids with their bikes and mostly boys, trading cards on the cul-de-sac, but it's not that. That is right. That's the past. The present is cross-generational. The present is, all demographics and walks of life. It's really exciting to see how the growth of women's sports, on the ice or on the court is now translating to also growth in the licensed product, that being in this case collectible trading cards.
When Tracy talked about how that nearly instant availability of card values also impacts how quickly those values change. So somebody has a 3-touchdown game on Sunday by Sunday afternoon. By Sunday night, Monday morning, that player's card value is jacked up. That's and people are buying and selling
it's like a commodities market.
Exactly. Yeah. And, so I'm sitting there thinking, people choose, who they want on their fantasy football teams, right? So the 3-touchdown game means your fantasy team had a better chance at winning. There seems to be these correlations now between, like, that instant gratification, in a good way, of fantasy football or any fantasy sport and collecting cards, right? So something that was always kind of a fun way as a kid collecting to learn how to invest, to target what is it that I want? What do I want to keep?
Right.
What do I want to sell? What deals do I want to make? You could see that play out in fantasy sports. Now you're seeing it play out in real time in collectibles.
Well, what's interesting too, and I think we both went there, and I'm glad you went there with Tracy as well, is how does off the field behavior or off the field news, affect the value of their card? And we talked about a Lance Armstrong. We talked about Travis Kelce with his fiance.
Yeah.
Someone like an O.J. Simpson, right? How did that affect the value, either higher or lower, of their card value based upon what was happening off the field?
Right. When you get notoriety, I'll give you an example. Damar Hamlin from the Buffalo Bills a few years ago, when he essentially had a cardiac episode on the field, his heart stopped on the field. Thankfully, due to the work of great medical professionals around him, his life was saved and he was back, the next season he was back out on the field. It's a story that, a terrible, heartbreaking story that had a great ending, right? How did that affect Damar Hamlin collectibles, right? And I'm not sure. He wasn't a prominent player. I don't know how many cards there were out there of him at the time, right? But knowing that, that type of notoriety, that type of attention can impact the values of cards. Now,
yeah.
Right?
I did stump Tracy a little bit on what obscure sports globally you know, are there trading cards for?
Right.
And I didn't think of a Tour de France trading card. But Tim, let's just think about here, right? On Skin in the Game, oftentimes we brainstorm new business ideas, right? You know, I'm thinking, what about journalists playing cards or trading cards?
Oh, there's been congressional trading cards. There was a congressman, long retired now, that I knew, you know, who, and again, this guy was in the United States Congress. He had made it to the height of professional politics. This dude was so excited when he got a trading card. That's what got him excited.
So, like, there's senators and Congress people who have their own trading cards?
There probably still are, but I'm talking a long time ago. But he thought was like, I really made it now that there's a trading card. Let me give you my
right
House of Representatives trading card.
That's classic. That's classic. Well, it was great to talk to Tracy from Panini. But Tim, as we wrap up this episode, I do need to ask you, do you have a favorite card? And I guess the other way I could word this is, if you could only be stuck on an island, deserted island, with one trading card, who would it be?
I do. It's very personal to me. I'll just tell you what it is, and you'll see why. So I have a 1933 Babe Ruth card.
Wow.
From the trading company Gaudy, Goudey. I got it from my grandfather, who used to collect these cards. And he did exactly what generations later people hoped hadn't happened, which was he stuck them on his bike spokes.
Mm.
I've got about 100 1933 Gaudis, including Babe Ruth. Every single one of them has a hole through the through the middle,
it's
rounded
character.
Corners.
It's character, yeah.
But the Babe Ruth card of all of them was the one ripped into four pieces, so it's taped together.
So do not go on eBay. Do not look at what a mint 1933 Babe Ruth card would be worth today.
Yeah, my daughter's college tuition. How about you? Same question, though. Do you have a favorite
card?
For
me, with trading cards, you know, and as a kid, I'd collect them and we'd trade them and put them on the bikes, all that. But for me, I always had the most affinity for, as you know, I'm a Cleveland baseball fan. So all the old Cleveland Indians players, many of the players in the 70s, 80s were not good. But I had an emotional connection to those players.
Yeah.
So I always valued those players and those cards more than the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Dodgers, because those were my guys, right? I do need to tell you, I had, from all my cards growing up as a kid, right? I had all my boxes of cards. Who knows what was in those? I go away to college. I come back home, look for my cards, and about 6 months ago, my mom had a great garage sale and all of my stuff was sold.
Which, by the way, that's the one question I wish I had asked Tracy. Does that happen anymore? You know, I mean, because there was a time, and it's the time frame you're talking about.
That's
right?
A dime. If you could find, and that's why I love garage sales, just because you can find the diamonds in the rough.
Right. Do people still, does that evade people? Does that elude people? And do they sell the cards still at a garage sale? Or are they immediately going online? Like Tracy said, go to eBay, get the value, go try to sell it to a dealer. Question for the next conversation. But before we wrap, John, Lynn Bader, our executive producer, just sent a note over. $750,000 would be the value of a mint 1933 Babe Ruth Gaudy. Admittedly, far more than my daughter's college tuition, even for 4 years. You could send a family to Ivy League college for that much money.
Well, I'm glad that you didn't have that card, because you probably wouldn't be sitting here doing Skin in the Game with me right now.
I'd just be wearing a custom suit. I'd be right here with you.
So thank you, Tracy Hackler from Panini America, for joining us here on Skin in the Game today. Tim, thanks for the great guest, and thank you for listening and watching. Until next week.
Skin in the Game is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. You can catch up with all our episodes on btpm.org or on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.